This morning, I want to follow up on a dream image I talked about on Tuesday. Remember, we talked about three main images in Pali's dreams. The image of time. If we have enough time, I will also look at how that image evolved a little bit over the course of Pali's life to the dream image of a Chinese woman, and then try to explain to you what that has to do with each other. I want to look at the theme of time and special moments of time, namely synchronicities. I thought I'd start off giving you an example of a synchronicity, which I saw about a year ago, and then we'll go through it together, interpreting the dream and the synchronicity. Here's the dream, which started the synchronicity process, and commentary on the dream, and then a synchronistic event of a 70-year-old male clinical psychologist. He was contemplating ending or seriously cutting back his practice and was asking himself, what am I going to do in the next phase of my life to make it meaningful? So while contemplating this transition, he had the following dream. I'm looking at a small white house from the side. There is a fenced area on this side of the house that runs from front to the back of the house. The grass is very green. In the fenced yard area is a beautiful horse. It is owned by a black couple, and I am told it is a champion. The horse's name is Havercock. Just get the main images in your... We'll talk about Havercock in a second. Get the main images. He's looking at a small white house. There's a fenced area on the side. He notices how green the grass is. In this area, there's a horse. It's a champion racehorse. The horse and house is owned by a black couple. He finds that strange because they're not usually involved in championship racing. And the horse's name is Havercock. So here's his commentary. Black couples do not typically own champion horses. The name Havercock is unusual, and I have no conscious memory of hearing that name. I Googled the name on the internet, followed the lead to a restaurant in Tuscany in the town of Montalcino. The principal chef in an apparently famous restaurant in Tuscany is Guido Havercock. The restaurant is in a very old castle in this ancient town in Tuscany. My only connection with Tuscany is that 2 years ago I attended a Jungian conference in that area. Now he reports the synchronicity that followed this dream. 8 days later, 8 days after this dream occurred, I was in Barnes & Noble. As I was working my way out of the store, I stopped at several display tables to look at the books on display. I wasn't looking for anything in particular. On the last table I stopped at, there was a book, A Vineyard in Tuscany, A Wine Lover's Dream, by Frank Mattei. He and his family live in a 13th century friary in Montalcino, Tuscany. Yes, I purchased the book. Now, just to save time, I've shortened what he said and simply extracted a little description of the book from a book review. This is the description of the book. Mattei recounts in wry, candid detail how he rebuilt a Tuscan ruin into a world-class winery. Living in Tuscany with his artist wife and son while savoring the landscape, food, and pleasant neighbors wasn't enough for Mattei, who admits he thrives on adversity. Oh, see, already you can hear the duplicity in themes, the difficulty of the blacks and the adversity of Mattei. He wanted his own castle and finagles the purchase of a 13th century friary in Montalcino with 60 acres of land, 15 of which he fashioned over 3 hard years of work into a vineyard, sprouting robust harvests of Sangiovese, Merlot, Cabernet Sauvignon, and Syrah grapes. While hacking in the forest, he finds the remains of a 3,000-year-old city, inviting the interests of archaeologists. So we have the dream, and then we have the events after the dream, in which the meaning of the dream is further elucidated. It is like the dream was not finished with the dream. The full dream consisted of the dream one night and the events at Barnes & Noble 8 days later. That is the first thing I would alert you to if you're dream workers or if you're working with your own dreams. Dreams are, at times, not finished with their nightly appearance. They continue on in the day in coincidental moments. In a phrase I'm going to repeat throughout this lecture, synchronicities carry the dream forward. Why is this a synchronicity? You will recall that a synchronicity is a non-causal and meaningful coincidence between an inner image or mood, in other words, a dream or a strong emotional state of mind, and an outer event. In our current example, the inner image was Haverkok. The outer event that coincided with that image was a situation in which there was a discovery at Barnes & Noble that the chef Haverkok was connected to a town in which a winery played an important part. The synchronicity evolved the meaning of the Haverkok image to be connected with a winery. The full image chain then goes from Haverkok in the dream to the name Haverkok being connected with Montalcino via a Google search, to a meaningful coincidence at Barnes & Noble, where the Haverkok and Montalcino themes were linked to a winery. The Haverkok image occurs in the dream, but then the Montalcino and the winery link occur in outer reality. The meaning of the horse Haverkok is not at all clear in the dream, but its meaning unravels in the subsequent themes which emerged in the later coincidence to be connected thematically with a winery. Again, note how matter carries the dream forward. Let me review. Sometimes dreams occur outside of us as well as inside of us. Important to remember if you're a dream interpreter. Jung calls these moments synchronicities. Acausal coincidences between an inner image and an outer event. These do not occur at all times, but only at certain moments. It's like time has a different qualitative possibility of characteristics. Synchronistic moments are these special moments. Hence, the time image in Pauli's dreams. I use the word acausal. These are acausal coincidences, acausal moments, not caused moments. I'll return to this shortly. Let's try to interpret the dream and the synchronicity because they belong together to form the text that we have to understand. What does the horse represent? Probably a certain quantity of energy in the dreamer, which can carry him forward to the next phase of his life with a certain degree of success, as indicated by the championship nature of the horse. Why does the black couple have the horse? His association to the black couple, as I alluded to a moment ago, is blacks have had to and have to struggle to attain their place in life. The move to the next phase of his life, therefore, will involve facing a certain degree of struggle. Why is there emphasis on the green field? Probably because even though it's a struggle, there is a promise of fertility and growth. Why the emphasis on the White House? Probably showing there's some naivete in him about how hard the battle will be. I'm sorry to say the dreamer rejected a sexual interpretation of Harrocock. He said, sex has never been a problem for me. The place where he does suffer over masculinity is in the area of creativity. He felt one of his main psychological issues was to be dealing with Erik Erikson's last stages of personal development. Now, you may not know that name, but Erikson divided life up into different phases where there are different challenges. The last phases that he described life to hold was the challenge, am I going to be generative? Am I going to end life generative, or am I going to end life in despair? So the dreamer felt, what I'm facing now is, can I have a generative last phase of my life? So the dreamer was asking himself how he could continue to live meaningfully through to the end of his life. He felt the phallic reference in the word Haverkok to refer to a cultural potency, a cultural creativity, masculine generativity and integrity in that sense. How does the winery now, appended to the dream by the synchronicity, add to the meaning of the dream? To sum up my interpretation, and then I'll explain how I got there, wine equals culture. Why do I say that? In the first stage of settled life, the first alcoholic beverage that is made is beer. A field is planted, the harvest is completed, the beverage is fermented all in one season. At that stage of settled life, most all of the effort of the community goes into the production of food. There isn't the leisure to have a class of artists and artisans to concentrate on art and cultural creation. If you're anthropologists, this would be the early Neolithic. As settled life becomes more efficient, less human effort is needed to produce food, and a class of artists and artisans can arise to make use of the leisure time. And likewise does the production of wine begin. Wine is a labor-intensive product that very early agrarian societies simply cannot muster the effort to produce. A, quote, wine society, on the other hand, has time to first get the vines ready, which may take 1 to 3 generations, to ferment and age the wine, 1 to 2 generations. It is at this point in history that art and culture develops. Since there is time and leisure to produce both wine and cultural artifacts. So Jung understands wine to represent a definite cultural achievement, which is the fruit of attention, patience, industry, devotion, and laborious toil. Wine, therefore, is an expression of cultural achievement. Where the vine is cultivated, civilized life prevails, Jung writes. So to sum up, the horse would represent the dreamer's ability to struggle against adversity, the blacks in the dream, and the adversity reference in the book description. This struggle would be in the service of cultural creation. The dreamer was a gay man and was being prompted through his inner urges and from his dreams, the leisure of his last years, to speak and write publicly about gay issues. This, then, would be the phallic creativity, which is alluded to in the horse's name, and which would make the last phase of his life meaningful, even at the cost of the adversity it would bring into it. Again, notice how the full sequence of the dream within himself and the images in the outer world together made the complete story. So events in physical reality and inner events in dream sleep make up sometimes the whole text, and we need to be alert to how reality can work to complete the dream. How is synchronicity possible? Jung knew that synchronicity flew in the face of all contemporary science. Science has no way of explaining how matter can operate symbolically, no way of understanding the connection between the inner psyche, although of course we know it's not only inner, and the outer world. In other words, the question emerges, what is the nature of matter that it can operate symbolically? His friendship with Pauli was important because Pauli was the one to encourage Jung to publish on synchronicity, where otherwise Jung may not have done so. Jung had to entertain the question, what's the nature of inner psychological processes that they can extend to matter? And on this question, Jung reformulated many of his basic ideas. That a Nobel laureate in physics took his work seriously gave Jung hope that his work might be accepted by a wider public. He wrote to Pauli, for example, "You have given me new heart." What I'd like to do now is look at the development in physics that sets the stage for this dialogue between Pauli and Jung, where they both recognized there is such a thing as a special moment, and that Pauli's discipline was interested because of the fact that matter operates in a particular way, Jung's discipline interested because he realized that the psyche extends outwardly. So just a very, very quick trip through some details of the developments of physics that Pauli was a part of to give you a sense of where these men found a common ground. A very quick history of some of the steps in the development of quantum physics. 1895, a man named J.J. Thomson discovered the electron in England. 1900, something very interesting happened. A physicist in Germany, Max Planck, and I just learned, if you want some complete trivia, Olivia Newton-John is his grandniece. Something you might need to know sometime. What Planck discovered was that energy is discontinuous. The old idea in physics was that energy could have any value it wanted. But what Planck discovered was energy can exist in only very discrete levels. It's like your car could go 5 miles an hour, 10 miles an hour, 15 miles an hour, but it can't go 2.5 miles an hour, 7.5 miles an hour. This was a radical break with the physics that existed before this time, which we call Newtonian, based on the work of Isaac Newton. The process continues with Ernst Rutherford in 1911, who discovered the nucleus of the atom. 1913, the place where Pauli would go to do his research, was in Copenhagen, and the administrator of this area was Niels Bohr. And Niels Bohr came up with the very first model of how he thought the nucleus of the atom and the electrons of the atom worked together. It turns out that was not quite adequate, so for the next 14 years, a team of physicists worked together to come up with what is now called the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics, which is what we're dealing with. Interestingly, it is the same period of Jung's night sea journey to the year. Here's what they were working with. This all started trying to understand the nature of light. I'm sure you've played with a prism as a kid. If you hold a prism up to sunlight, you get the rainbow. If you hold a prism up to a single gas that is activated by heat or electricity, you don't get the complete rainbow. You get a set of very discrete colors. The reason the rainbow is a smear of colors is because there's a whole pile of gases in the sun. we would probably know neon, which is not quite a good analogy because the colors you see on neon lights are often added because there's something added to them. But just take a hydrogen, whatever it is, you heat it up, it starts to glow, you get a very specific band of colors. The light is then put through a prism, a very, 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 very precise prism, which breaks the light up into what are called spectral lines. This is what they couldn't figure out. They couldn't figure out how to predict the spectral lines from a given atom. What they eventually discovered, Pauli being one of the team that discovered this, is that if you energize an atom, an electron in that atom will jump up a orbital level, and then it will give off its energy as it falls back, and when it does so, it'll give off light. So electrons change state in an energized atom, and then they fall back. The puzzle and the unique feature here, the new feature, is that when you activate an atom, let's say there's an electron here, that atom may go up to the very top, and it may go back directly. Or it may go up to the top, stopping at other orbits on the way. And when it's up here, it may fall back directly, or it may fall back via short stops at other atoms on the way. And then for each gap where there's a movement and a stop, a different color of light is emitted. That's what they figured out in those 14 years. But what is so important for us is what they realized, and it's another feature that breaks with all previous physics, is that they cannot predict the movement of that electron when the atom is energized. At the very heart of matter, you see there's pure chance. On the average of all the movements, you can see a set of patterns, but they realize that within the atom itself, causality breaks down, and chance rules. You see how Jung and Pauli had so much to talk about. Jung realized synchronistic events are chance events. Pauli realized that electron movement is a chance event. This old idea that everything can be predicted by science has fallen apart, and room is created for the miracle to enter in. So the key word has developed out of Jung's work on synchronicity and Pauli's work on quantum physics is this word chance. Let's take a look at this word chance. What I want to do now, if Murphy cooperates, is play you a little video clip of Jung talking about chance, and then we'll come back and look at that. I just have to see if this will work. So keep your fingers crossed. Oh, there we go. Okay.
Only 50 years ago at Duke University, researchers began developing better methods for gathering evidence of ESP. The earliest laboratory work on psychic phenomena was done here at the Institute for Parapsychology. The Institute, which is now an independent research center, was established by a former botanist, Joseph Banks Rhine. In his studies, Rhine used these five distinctive cards. With cards, he could use statistics to assess the results of his experiments. In this unique archive film of a typical test, the subject had to guess the order of a pack of 25 cards dealt face down by the experimenter. She pointed to each symbol to indicate her guess. When the experiment was over, the experimenter counted up the number of correct guesses.
Your score was. You got one circle.
To find out if she was psychic, Ryan used the standard laws of chance.
Two waves.
The pack of 25 cards contained five lots of five separate symbols. Statistically, over a long series of tests, she should have guessed five cards right by chance.
9, 10, 11. That's marvelous. 6, 1.
But one experiment proved nothing. Rhine did thousands of trials on hundreds of people. This one tested the power of mind over matter to affect the fall of dice.
5, 1. 2, 1.
Prolonged testing was essential because for statistical proof, they needed consistent scores well above chance. Another experiment examined foretelling the future. The subject had to list the five symbols in the order in which she thought the experimenter would list them after the test. A table of random numbers determined the order in which he put his list.
So this is a very good score. You would expect a score of 5 by chance, but you have a score of 11. So that's really very fine.
Ryan identified 4 psychic abilities: telepathy, mind-to-mind communication; clairvoyance, seeing things at a distance; precognition, knowing the future. These he called extrasensory perception. On its own, psychokinesis, moving things at a distance. To describe all 4 abilities, Ryan coined the term psi. He said there was firm proof for 3 of them.
We can say that clairvoyance, the precognition, and PK, a moving target, are in this very firm category. It begins to look as though it's the capacity, psi capacity in general, including ESP and PK, is a natural property, natural capacity.
Now I'm going to say something which in these sacred rooms is anathema. a relativation of time and space through the psyche. And that's the fact. Yeah. And that is what Ryan has made evident.
Yeah.
Now swallow that.
Well,
that's difficult. Yeah.
Well, may I go a little further? And of course, some of your recent work, which is indeed very profound, and it is not too well known to many of our students.
Of course not.
And of course, this
nobody
is...
reads these things. Only the general public.
And
because my books are at least sold.
I'm referring now to the concept of synchronicity, which you have discussed,
yeah.
And which would have some relevance at this point in our discussion. Would you care to comment a little bit on this concept?
That is awfully complicated. One wouldn't know where to begin. Of course, it is this kind of thinking has been started long ago, and when Ryan brought out these results, I thought now we have at least a more or less dependable basis to argue on, you know. But the argument was not understood at all, because it's really very, very difficult. You know, there are plenty of facts in the observation of the unconscious where you come across cases of a very peculiar kind of parallel events. Namely, that, say, I have a certain thought or a certain definite subject is occupying my attention, yeah, my interest. At the same time, something else, quite independently, happens that portrays just that thought.
Yes.
Now, this is utter nonsense, you know, looked at from a causal point of view. That it is not nonsense is made evident by the results of Ryan's experiments. There is a probability, it is something more than chance, that such a case occurs. Now I never made statistical experiments,
yeah,
to except one in the way of Ryan. I have made one for another purpose. But I have come across quite a number of cases where it was most astounding to find that two causal chains happened at the same time, but independent upon each other, so that you could say they have nothing to do with each other.
Yeah.
Of course, it's quite clear. For instance, just so I speak of a red car, and at that moment a red car comes here, you see.
Yes.
Now, I haven't seen it. It was impossible because it was behind the building. In this moment, the red car appears. Now, this is... that's mere chance. The Reif's experiment proves that these cases are not mere chances. Of course, many of these things are occurrences where we cannot apply such an argument, otherwise we would be superstitious. We can't say, now this car has appeared because here was some remarks have been made about the red car.
Yes. It's not cause and effect.
Oh, this is a miracle that the red car appears. It is not, it is chance, just chance. But these chances happen more often than chance allows.
Yes.
And that shows that there is something behind it.
Yeah.
So you see, in the Rhine has a whole institute and with many co-workers.
Yes.
And has the means. We have no means here, you know, and I had no means to make such an experiments, otherwise I probably would have done them. But it was physically impossible. So I had to content myself with the observation of facts.
If you're interested in that video, it's now available for sale at a ridiculously high price. There are references on my website for all the things we've done today, and including that video. It's a four-hour video done in 1957, and it's now been put out by Penn State. So if you're interested. Well, the key phrase there, and the reason I wanted to show it to you, is this way he phrases it as chance that happens more often than chance allows. And could you understand the non-causal? It's not because he had the dream that he saw the book in Barnes & Noble, but the two things happened more or less simultaneously. That's what Jung is trying to get at. So a door has opened then between Jung's recognition of synchronicity, chance that is more than chance, and quantum physics' recognition of chance at the heart of matter, again, why Jung and Pauli had so much to talk about. And again, remember that these are not caused experiences. Both in physics and in psychology, the limits of causality in explaining our lives is very clearly evident. So in the place of causality, Jung puts meaningful chance. This is a major shift in the way we understand ourselves. So much of psychology explains present experiences and difficulties in life as being caused by the past. But both physics and Jung have realized, however, there is a relative importance of this effect of causality. The physicist sees the presence of chance within the atom. Jung sees it within the personality. But Jung additionally recognizes that the chance in our personal lives can be meaningful. Meaningful chance is working in our lives and is trying to move our development and growth forward. The inborn healing process that Jung discovered in those years of his night sea journey and that he spent his life describing are based on a recognition that there is a movement in the psyche which is not causal. And the business of this movement in the psyche is not the past, but the future. His job is not to be created by the past, but to rather create the future. The dreamer I told you about, in fact, had a hard life. I'll spare you the details. But the psyche continues to attempt to create a future for this man in these special chance moments of life in which the inner and outer duplicate each other and seek to lead him and us into a new and more satisfactory life. I've tried to keep the presentations here at the introductory level, so I talked about Mercurius, I talked about that sex having a message. As that theme evolved forward in Pauli's dreams, that message was described in dreams not as sex, but as Sophia, as Larry was talking about just previously. As I said, we don't have time to get into that. The the way the time issue evolved in Pauli's dreams over the course of his lifetime is that he started dreaming less of time, but more of Chinese women. So the Chinese woman somehow has something to do with this nature of time and chance and synchronicity. So I'd like to give you now one of his dreams in which a Chinese woman appears. I'm not going to go into it in great detail, but I will lift out a couple of the very interesting points to show you how this theme of time evolves and the breadth of expression it began to take in Pauli's psyche. The Dark One. I don't know if you remember the very first dream. The Dark One wanted a book written, and he goes into a brothel, so you could say the prostitute would be the Dark One, but now she's changed. Now she's become a Chinese woman. The Dark One is present, and she appears this time quite distinctly as a Chinese woman. She says nothing, but her movements are dance-like and mime-like, something like in a ballet. She is very beautiful, completely dark-haired, small and delicate, and she has almond eyes. She beckons me to follow her and goes ahead dancing. She opens a trap door which goes to a floor below. She leaves the door open and we descend through it. In the basement, she opens another door, and in front of me is an auditorium in which unknown people are sitting. Actually, some of them are no longer completely unknown. I can indeed recognize a few of them. The Chinese woman begins to dance. The Chinese woman indicates with hand movements that I should get up on the podium and deliver a lecture. You see how repeatedly the dreams come back. Publish a book, give a lecture, as if to say it is time now for this message to reach the world. She is pointing upwards with the index finger of her left hand and pointing down with the index finger of her right hand. Aha, I think. And I think here's the most important sentence. One should hear above what I am saying below. So up and down now are united. She dances rhythmically back up the steps, through the door, into the open air, and then back down again, pointing to me on the podium. For her, there is no difference between above and below, I think to myself. As I am actually following her lead, slowly and thoughtfully mounting the podium, I wake up. Let's just look at a couple of the main themes. We could spend endless hours on the meaning of the Chinese image. I think the easiest thing, and I'll try to explain it briefly, is to say that what the Chinese woman represents is what the I Ching represents. The I Ching, probably some of you have done the I Ching workshop here. Some of you probably have no idea what I'm talking about. Is that fair to say? The I Ching is a Chinese oracle, goes back to about 3000 BC. There are several methods of constructing an oracular image, sometimes by throwing coins, sometimes by throwing sticks. A pattern is created out of that throw. It's an oracular throw. And it is thought that that throw is a reading of the moment of time. So if you have a certain problem, you put the question to the I Ching, you throw the coin, and what you get is a reading for what the qualitative moment of time is and how it will affect your question. What interested Jung so much, and von Franz picked this up more in her book, Number and Time, is that the I Ching tries to read the qualitative moment of time through a single chance throw. It is exactly opposite the viewpoint of Western science, which tries to exclude chance from experiment, where the Chinese mentality, the early Chinese mentality, the ancient Chinese mentality, put the single chance event as the center of attention. So the Chinese woman would probably represent a point of view which can see and understand the meaningful chance event. Again, there is no difference between above and below. The heavenly and the earthly are now pushing to be seen as one phenomenon. I think, again, as Joyce started out saying, the spirit from the earth would be the sense that reality has a time moment which reflects a greater pattern of life. And to read where our life can go, we have to concentrate here on the material world in time and space. Well, let me sum up. This morning I've talked about synchronicity with an example to show how the inner world can extend to the outer world and how the outer material world can manifest with intelligence for our personal journey. We've looked at the issue of causality and its inadequacy in helping us understand how our life can develop. There are particular moments of time in which the inner world and outer world provide us guidance in the creation of a meaningful future. I undertook this exploration into synchronicity, time, purpose, and causality because it was one of the three main images in Pauli's dreams. As I was working on this last lecture, it came back to me that this theme of the Oriental, Eastern viewpoint, which comes up toward the end of Pauli's life, is a very important one to me. I'd like to tell you why. I was in the Peace Corps in the early 70s, and I worked in a small town in the southwestern side of South Korea. And I had a fantastic boss who told me the story of how he was conscripted into the Japanese army during the Second World War. Korea had been invaded by the Japanese, and all Korean men were conscripted into the Japanese army. He said on August 8, 1945, he was driving his Jeep away from Hiroshima when his eyes went blank with white light. He felt a gust of wind blow him head over heels out of his Jeep. He laid face down in the earth until the awful roar ceased, and he turned around and saw the mushroom cloud arising over Hiroshima. He said he was in the very first team that went into Hiroshima to try to begin dealing with the damage. He said, you can't imagine what it's like reaching for a child's outstretched arm and take it to have the skin peel off in your hand. I don't know if you know Koreans, but they are a tough lot. But as he told me that, he sobbed convulsively. And he said, there must be no Hiroshimas. There must be no more Hiroshimas. Please promise me. This came back to me recently when I saw a movie called Hiroshima Mon Amour by Marguerite Duras, a French novelist, now deceased. It's a wonderful movie. If you have a chance, get it. It's black and white. Done shortly after the bomb went off, I think, in the 50s. It's a story of a French female journalist, who goes to Hiroshima and falls in love with a Japanese man. I won't ruin the movie for you, but I will tell you, by the end of the movie, we don't know whether their relationship will survive or whether it will fall apart. And then I remember Marie-Louise von France telling me of one of the most impressive dreams she'd ever seen was of a woman dreaming of that movie. And the dream said, if the couple got back together again, the world would survive. If the couple did not get back together again, the world would be destroyed in a nuclear holocaust. I think we see that very same movement in Pauli's dreams, with the East now moving to the West, as we reevaluate what space is, what time is, what sexuality is. All these issues are now on our plate to make our own and to find our own relationship to. Thank you.